Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. This is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. Just whenever I get round to finishing a book, I do the review, stick it up here in the podcast feed. But this is a very special episode and also an out-of-sequence episode. This is episode, I think, number 98. And episode 98 was meant to be Patrick Rothfuss's The Name of the Wind, which I read before this book, The Stars, My Destination. But it's been about 2 weeks, and I've still, exactly 2 weeks now, recording this on Monday, that I finished the book, and I have still not got around to recording it because I've been at home and very, very busy with very many things, lots of different things. But I'm heading away on another work trip tomorrow, and I'll definitely have time to catch up on the podcasting. Meanwhile, this is a podcast recorded with me and Scott and Jesse and Julie, all actually organised by Jesse from the SFF Audio podcast. But I don't mind putting this out as an SFBRP podcast, mainly because I said to Jesse, oh, and I've got here The Stars, My Destination to read. And he's like, that's going to be our next read-along book. So the only reason that they're doing this, or that we did it for the SFF Audio, is because this was a book that I wanted to read and we thought it would be an interesting book to discuss on that podcast. So this is not just me. This is going to be four people discussing the book. So it's a little bit different, a little bit special, and I hope you enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed recording it yesterday. So here we go.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Jesse.
And I'm Julie from Forgotten Classics.
And I'm Luke from the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast.
Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Luke and Julie, this is the first time you've been on a podcast together. Is that right?
Yeah, I've done a few of these SFBRP things. No, not these sort of crossover things as well. With the SFF Audio, I did. What was it? The Steel Remains, and we did the Invisible Man. Me and Jesse did it as well. But it's great. And I've done some other bits and pieces. I'm sure I can't remember all the times. But yeah, it's the first time, and I never. But it's strange because I've heard Julie quite a few times on this podcast over the last few read-alongs. So it's
yeah, you were actually fated to meet earlier with the one we did that was public domain.
The State of Civilization. Yes. And I was going to do that, but I was, you know, what happened was that I was away, and then there was the whole volcano ash cloud thing going on, so I never managed to I was all delayed, and I thought I'd be home by then, but that was it. But this one is really great because we rescheduled this, because otherwise I'd have been away again, ironically enough.
We had to get you back on and together. Yeah. Today we're going to talk about The Demolished Man. The Stars, My Destination by Professor.
Yeah.
So.
What's up?
Yes.
How'd everybody like it?
I loved it.
Oh, no, let's do that. We'll talk about the book first and then go into liking it or disliking it.
Okay, let's do it in your order.
No, okay, well, okay, forget it. You do what you want.
No, that's okay.
Scott liked it. Why do you like it, Scott?
It was really good. No. No,
Luke was right. Never mind.
Podcast finished.
Yeah, thanks for coming, everybody. No. I liked quite a bit about it. I guess Luke is right in that we probably should talk about the
yes, he's right.
What it's
he's
about
completely right.
Before, so that you know what I say makes sense.
Yep.
So what it's about is a fellow named Gulliver Foyle, who begins the book stuck on a ship, trying to get out. It's kind of amazing. You know, the kind of the situation that he's in. So he's in a closet with air in it, and every time his air bottle goes out, he needs to go outside into the vacuum of space, go get another bottle and put it back in his closet, and then close the door and open the bottle.
The whole bit, him being shipwrecked, but like spaceship wrecked at the beginning, I actually really like that. But the real beginning, like there's like the prologue, I guess it is where you find out about jaunting. And I think this is quite an important thing so people understand. Even though it's strange that it informs the story quite a bit, but it's almost like the story could have been told without the jaunting. And the jaunting is this
symbolic.
Innate. Yeah, it's like this innate ability of all humans, and they worked out that one guy. It's a bit of a strange beginning of the book. He was in a life-threatening situation. He worked out that he can actually teleport, but only people who were in a life-threatening situation could do it. And he's like, bamf, and teleports.
I like the reference.
Bamf. and yeah, no, where's that from?
That's
I can't even remember.
The X-Men.
X-Men. Yeah, I've only seen the films of the X-Men. You know, I'm not a comic book fan or something like that. But when I saw it, I thought, oh, this is like, you know, I remember seeing the guy bamfing in the films there. So
actually, you know who ripped it off completely?
What's that?
Stephen Gould when he wrote Jumper. Jumper.
Oh, really?
Exactly the same as Jaunting.
I don't know what I've not seen Jumper or don't know
did
what
you,
Jumper is.
Did they also have to be afraid of their lives before they could do it?
Yeah.
Well, that's something
it's exactly
I've
exactly the same.
Yeah, okay. That's
except for the origin story. It's exactly
yeah. That's something I've read a few times before, like the whole, oh, you've got to do it, but you'll only be able to do it if you're, you know, in mortal danger, you know, and it's your last way out. But the thing is, unlike these, I guess, the X-Files, not the X-Files, the X-Men and these other superhero things, is that suddenly, well, not suddenly, but over a period of a few generations, everybody learns how to jaunt around and teleport, and there's different limits, and nobody's been able to teleport across space. So when our, you know, Gully is shipwrecked in space, he can't teleport away, because normally you'd be able to teleport to safety from most situations, except if you're moving or in space. You know, you have to know where you're going to, and you have to know where you are. And if you're in orbit, you can't see that at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean, Jesse, by jaunting is symbolic?
Oh, well, our hero, right? He's a no man in the sense that he's not of any importance. He has no prospects. He has no interests. He has no nothing, right?
Yeah.
But when he's tested, when his life throws him a series of horrible, series of horrible events, he becomes something symbolic in him. Is shown, and that is his ability to jaunt much farther than anyone else is capable of, right?
Well,
yes, but we only find that out, like, you know, just after that. But
we don't even know that he can jaunt at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, well, no, everyone can jaunt at the beginning of the book, but I do know what you mean about it's a bit symbolic. It's only when he's put into a life-threatening situation is then he can get himself out of the shipwreck, and he goes about it, you know, he does this and he starts the engine and he goes around. So it's literally mirrored immediately from the beginning of the book of when they're talking about people, you know, they actually solicit suicide people who are suicidal to see if, hey, we'll put you in this life-threatening situation and see if you can jaunt out. And if not, it doesn't matter because you want to die anyway, you know, and it actually says it was quite a bad time.
By the way, what did you think of the idea of naming Jaunt after Jaunt, like a man named Jaunt is the I mean, it's all,
yeah, it was a bit silly.
It's a bit silly, but then I noticed it in the audiobook, and then I just checked it now in the actual textbook as well, that the man's name is not just Jaunt, it's Charles Fort Jaunt. And if you guys know who Charles Fort is, he's just throwing it in your face.
Who is he?
Charles Fort is like a guy who wrote about all the strange phenomena of the Earth. He is like,
oh, and the, was he the guy who wrote about teleporting for the first time?
He's the guy who wrote about any sort of strange phenomena. And so
right.
There's this Fortian phenomena thing. So ball.
Yeah, I think I've heard of him, but I don't.
Anything paranormal, supernatural, and he's the guy who collects all the stories, ufology and cryptozoology, all that's basically the father of that as a, you know, movement. And so there's a magazine called Fortian Times now.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, but I don't mind that it was named after him, because, I mean, I was just reading this morning about, you know, there was a man named Doily who did special lace work, and Doily was named after him. So these things happen. I realize it was rather obvious, and he's showing us this, but I could go with that.
Yeah, Germany just scored against England, by the way.
Or whatever the sound is.
No, I don't care. I'm English, but I live in Germany, and so I really don't mind who wins out of this game. But I think it's a bit strange that, you know, this is a reference to this person, this is a reference to this person. But for me, that kind of writing, and there's a lot of it going on in this book, I found a lot of it going on in this book. It's like, yeah, sure, okay, so you know this person. We'll just name it after him. It's like a game, but it doesn't actually make the book better, and it doesn't actually make it more interesting. Do you understand?
Yes,
it doesn't say anything more.
It doesn't add depth.
No, it doesn't have depth. And I found that time and time again in this book. I'm like, sure, it's a retelling of this story, or it's a retelling of that story. Oh, and I can see this reference, I can see that reference. But it's just sort of like on a top layer, like you say. It's like, oh, and this person is actually this person. I'm like, oh, right. But now that I know that, it doesn't actually bring anything else out of the book. You know, it doesn't actually bring anything else out of the, out of the text, except, oh, yeah, of course,
Can I just add one thing that kind of would finish where the story's going? Because we set up that he's shipwrecked, but basically what happens is a ship comes along, who he's like, oh, yay, rescue me, and he sets off signals or something, and then they just kind of ignore him and go on, and that sets the entire path for the book, because he is determined to survive, so he may have extreme vengeance on this ship, and he was able to see the name, so he's got the ship's name, and his life's mission then becomes to extract vengeance from whoever passed him by and left him to die.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So everything he does is because of that.
Yeah, let's get into the point of that it's a retelling of, or a kind
well,
of retelling.
Well, that starts the Count of Monte Cristo theme right there.
Yeah,
well,
and
let's do the book starts with the lines from Blake. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? It's supposed to be pronounced symmetry, right?
Well, I don't know.
It's going to rhyme.
I'd probably say symmetry, probably.
Yeah, but it's a forced rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
I think
symmetry.
That's why
got it. Okay.
Hand or eye, right? Bright
night. Yep.
Okay, I think that's how it's supposed to be pronounced, just because it's a forced rhyme. That I think the poem actually informs the story as well. If you've got it there, it says those are the first lines. Who is the tiger? Tiger? Well, it's our main character, right?
Yeah.
He's got a tiger on the face. I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, that's what it. Well, just to say, when he does escape from the shipwreck, he gets picked up and by this sort of like scientist religion kind of group. And they tattoo his face, so that's a
sort of
one
a
of those
tiger,
strange things.
A tiger pattern from, I guess, New Zealand, a Maori stuff.
Yeah, some kind. Yeah, I was thinking sort of like a Maori kind of lots of black swirly line kind of things going on there. Is
and
what I imagine.
The next lines are: in what distant deep or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what should and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? I mean, if you think about what kind of character this guy is, right? He's a rapist, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not super obvious. It's not spelled out for you right away, but later on he admits it. And he's.
I think it isn't. It's not like it's not spelled out for you, but it's like not spelled out. You know, it's one of those strange things. It's like,
he threw her to the couch.
Yeah, it's like he threw her for the couch, and then a minute later they're ravaging each other, and I'm like, is it really ravaging each other, or is it
the narrator's
bit one sided?
Yeah.
So it's a bit.
Well,
strange.
The whole Blake poem is about, If these things were created, how can... Well, there's one line that says, did he who make the lamb make thee? So he's describing how terrible the tiger is and, how fierce it is and all this. And how could the same thing that created the lamb create the tiger? And I think that's one of the themes of the book.
Yeah, there's a religious theme in the book as well.
Even though it's a very atheistic society and religion is... banned,
right.
Can't do it. Everyone has to, it's all like underground religion and Bible smuggling.
Luke yesterday, briefly, and I made a note as soon as I talked to him.
Oh yeah, about pornography.
Do you guys remember the scene in which pornography is mentioned?
I do not.
He's in Italy, and he's looking for one of the guys who's on the ship, and he comes across him, but it's actually someone pretending to be Italian, someone who's against him, and he's a peddler in pornography, and he describes the pornography, and it's not pornography in the sense that we think of it. It's pictures of people kissing a cross and pictures of people.
I do remember that.
Oh,
yeah.
Right. I forgot that.
Pornography is religious symbology.
Yeah.
How did I not remember that? Come on.
Yeah, they talk about swearing as well. It's like, oh, what does Jesus Christ mean? That's like, can't you say, don't say that. You can't say that.
Yeah, she's educating him.
It's mentioned this a few times as well, like, you know, what the hang up is of the culture that becomes the swearing, like, you know, because people say that, I don't know how much it is, but like in English and America it's all about sex, but then in French it's more about religion and excrement and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yes, but the thing is, I don't know enough about that, but it is just one of those things that you sort of hear.
So our future ones are going to be spam.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be
spammer
the,
you.
The bad
Ooh,
things about
what a troll.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. See, we're already partway there. Take that back.
So there's, like I say, there's lots of these different themes and lots of different ideas, and I thought the world that it's set in is actually quite well realized. I love the people who there's a whole sequence of scenes set up in New Year's, and they're following the new year around the world. That's been done lots before. Maybe lots since as well. This book, so I've actually seen that played out in science fiction before.
Louis Wu in
yeah,
Ring
that's
World.
Who I was going to mention is Louis Wu in
yeah,
Ring
that's
World.
That's. Yeah, Ringworld is one of those things that
they have a more science fiction explanation for how you travel around the world, right? This one is
however, it's pretty much the same, except there it's sort of hand wavy in technology, and here it's hand wavy in physiology. However, it's pretty much the same, because there they go from one known spot where they know nobody's going to be, so this is wide areas, so they don't and it's the same in this with the Louis Wu in Ringworld and those guys, because they have the same they have a similar kind of thing, that they go from one spot to the next and then from one spot to the next, so I thought it was very similar. But no, it's just the whole idea there, and you get the jackers who go around just when it starts getting dark, or just when people start going out to work and their houses are empty, and then they come in there and they find the empty buildings and the abandoned buildings and things and rip them off, and it's this whole sort of like roving society that just keep going around the world. And
I think that's one of the coolest aspects of the book.
I thought the world was the most.
He informs it with those the labyrinths. Everybody has to have a labyrinth in their house entrance so that nobody can figure out how to get in and steal all your stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I remember another detail about the girls' rooms, daughters' rooms having no windows, so nobody could see into there and jaunt in.
Yeah.
I also liked the way the wealthy people were shown, because it harkened back to what I think of as ancient Europe. You know, everybody was just sitting around in these socials, elaborately dressed, talking to each other, being extremely frivolous. Mm. And the whole concept of if you were really wealthy and important, you did not jaunt. You took a regular way of transport.
Yeah,
you
were that felt like satire.
Bad time.
Whole part is satire, but it's a really good. I really like the kind of dystopian satire going on here.
Yeah,
you think about how rich people now they have sailboats, right? Sailboats are not really great technology for getting where you want to go really fast. So what do they do?
Really
with there's the guy who has a is it our main character who has a train that lays down track before he
he brings his circus in on it.
Yeah.
But the thing I liked about it, though, was the fact that I related to that, because now what does nobody have enough of? Time. And so those people were so wealthy, they had time, and that's what they flaunted in a way. So I liked that aspect of it.
What I liked about that as well is, well, not what I liked about it, but it's his always his first entrance. The way that they arrive at the at the parties has to be the big thing.
Grand. So,
and I do remember that actually from the film of the Count of Monte Cristo was one of those things that I remember. He came in on a hot air balloon, and I thought, well, that's a bit elaborate. But then, of course, that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to hide in plain sight at the top of society, with all the rich. With all the rich people and everything like that. So I thought that part of the book was really good, just how over the top it was, because you have to make an entrance. And there's other point where there's also other sort of mind skills as well. You get the telepaths and things.
Which is so, more Demolished Man what's the reading order? What's the publication order of these two books? Because that book is fully developed, right? And this one feels a little bit undercooked in the that one department, but there's so much in it already. It might have been just I'm looking at it here. It says 1956 for the copyright, so I guess we can figure that out.
I don't know when the Demolished Man was, but the thing I found interesting is the edition of the book that I had a very interesting foreword that I read afterwards. So
the Neil Gaiman one? Is that the one you have?
No, this is an older one, because I got a library book, but it was by a guy named Paul Williams. And but he made a point that I think contributed to the fact that the book did feel kind of unfinished and rushed for me. But now that you're mentioning all these details, I wonder if I go back and reread it more slowly, because he called it one of the first pyrotechnic novels. And he says, and maybe you guys all know this, but I didn't. He says it's constructed quite literally like a chain of firecrackers. Each firecracker igniting the next, each explosion necessarily bigger than the last in order to sustain the impact on the reader. Such a novel, when done well, totally exhausts its reader with its astonishing pace of ideas and events, yet is so gripping that the reader must go on reading in spite of his own exhaustion, triggering a sort of intellectual overdrive, a surge of adrenaline that replaces exhaustion with a state of super-awareness. The breathless conclusion of a pyrotechnic novel leaves the reader certain that more things have happened to him than his dazed mind will ever be able to comprehend or remember. And I read that and just went, bingo, that was me. Where I just felt like the reason it felt unfinished to me is because I did not grasp everything fully, and I would need to read it again to see if
I think this is a book
right
that you need to reread, because obviously we're all picking up on things that
are
in there, but not completely obvious. And the more I look at this book, the more I see in there. And yet there are, it's not all hidden away either.
And it reminds me. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just saying that. Yeah, I understand what you're saying about that with a pyrotechnic. And one firecracker setting off the next.
Mm-hmm.
However, I see what they're doing. I can see what he's doing now, if that's what he's attempting, but I don't think it makes for a very interesting story or a very deep story. Sure, there's a lot of that, there's lots of stuff in here that I didn't pick up on, when you've already touched on some of those things already that I noticed, Germany 2, England 0, that I noticed and you guys didn't, and then other people have noticed and I didn't. That's fine. However, it's like a game, but I don't find it... I didn't find any of the things that the main character was doing particularly interesting at all. There's lots of stuff going on in the book all the time, lots of stuff here and lots of stuff there, and it does go off like a firecracker, like one thing goes off after the other, but I didn't actually like I didn't like the main character for a start, and his story didn't interest me very much at all. The whole revenge story done well can be good, but however, he does fall into a lot of money, like the Count of Monte Cristo,
mm-hmm.
but yet his revenge story keeps going on. And I didn't find that compelling. I didn't believe that he managed to get out of this situation. He's on top of the world. He's one of the richest men in the world. And it's all going well. Oh, England just scored, I think. So that's all working out really well for him. But then the story itself doesn't go anywhere, and no matter how many of the how much other stuff goes on, all these firecrackers and this event going off and this event going off and this event going off, if I don't care about the original mission and I don't care about the character, it doesn't leave me a lot to go with in terms of interest in the novel. And unlike, I mean, this guy in this afterwards that you just read, he said it was like, yeah, you keep going and keep going, and you're left with this overall sense of not knowing everything. I think that sounds more like an excuse for a book which is a bit of a mess and needs editing down into something, and with, you know, and it's not standing up as a story. It's like an excuse for the novel rather than it's like a bug, not a feature, I guess, is one thing, one way you could look at it. Yeah, does that make sense?
I felt kind of the opposite, because I have read this sometime a long time ago, and this time when I read it, I liked it way more than I did then, and I'm not certain why it is, but the foil to me was a spectacle throughout the whole thing, and I never did lose my interest in him. You know, it was more like an open mouth wow throughout the whole thing. It's just like, you know, especially in the first part. You know, in the first book, all through when he's, stuck in the ship and everything that he does. I mean, the images in my head, and they were just absolutely fantastic all the way through the end of that. Did they call it the first book? I can't remember. It's a section. Anyway, it was like
a prologue
or whatever. No, it wasn't the prologue. It was
no, it was actually
section.
When he was shipwrecked. Yeah, I thought the shipwreck at the beginning was amazing. And
part
then...
two.
Yeah, okay. And then when he actually had to encounter somebody else, and it just goes, and he meets up with these people, and he just escaped, and he escaped with all this money, or whatever. He didn't have the money by then. He's like, oh, yeah, and then he escaped, and he just killed all these people and wiped these people out here. And I was just like, oh, so it's one of those people. And I guess maybe that's – I didn't pick up on that so much in the first time I read this novel years ago. So that's a bit
– I guess I'm just saying I never did lose my interest in him, you know. But the first portion of the book is different, you know.
Yeah.
It like shifts gears into the second portion. But in the second portion, what you've got is all the societal stuff that's going on that you don't see in the first part.
I enjoyed the different aspects of it, and it was put it this way, if it wasn't for this podcast that we're doing now and for like the 100 of people who've suggested I read this book and review it, I probably wouldn't have bothered finishing it because I just didn't find it that enjoyable. And I tried it, I thought, oh, maybe it's just the narration, and then I went across and I read probably about a third of this book as a paper book, as a real book, and then about the rest of it I listened to as an audio book, which I actually quite enjoyed the narration.
Library of Congress Book for the Blind.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's not available as an audiobook, there's no plans. There's apparently some fight amongst the heirs of Bester who owns the rights, and I was just in the bookstore trying to find another copy, and I've got my old hardcover here, but they don't have a paperback in the bookstore. This is a huge book in science fiction, and even if Luke doesn't think it's worthy.
I understand why people think it is worthy, because the book itself thinks it's very worthy, and it is one of these very worthy books. But do you understand what I'm saying, though? That's the level.
I think you have to be interested in the overall theme of transformation, because that's, I mean, I'm going to stick with the Count of Monte Cristo in a sense, because I don't want to give anything away,
review of the book we did previously, The Status Civilization, was very arrogant as well. It sounded like, you know, Sheckley can do much better than this.
I recall that.
And I think Alfred Bester is very proud of himself, and it sort of shows up in this book.
Oh, so much.
But I think what he's done is pretty impressive.
It feels too much like a construct. It's like, oh, and I'm going to put in this reference, and this is, oh, check this out. I gave before of him going, someone has to be able to jaunt, but they can only jaunt in a, you know, they can only change in that way and actually go through this next step in the human journey when they're in a life-threatening situation. Oh, and check it out, next chapter we're going to put someone in a life-threatening situation, and that's going to be the thing that, you know, transforms him and makes him go up, you know, into his next level of growth. You understand?
Perhaps it's because he wasn't very smooth at putting together all the different influences, because I was really interested. We keep mentioning the Count of Monte Cristo, but the fact that his name is Gulliver Foyle And the first place that in Gulliver's, or the second place after the, you know, the Lilliputians that Gulliver visits in Gulliver's Travels is, I can't remember the name of it, but I just was looking it up, and it was a floating like cloud city where the people were devoted to the arts of music and mathematics, but utterly unable to use these for practical ends. Yeah. Well, when he's rescued, that's like the asteroid people who I absolutely loved. Arrival of the Fittest is the doctrine of Holy Darwin. Most scientific. And they're, of course, just savages.
Most scientific. And, yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so there's that point. And then the fact that he uses type and images in interesting ways, which I don't know how that would have done in the audiobook, but
yeah, I was a bit nervous about how that would come across, but it was actually done quite well, I think, in the
okay.
Although I noticed when I was reading along that the version that the narrator had was different than mine, so there were some lines missing.
This was saying he wrote comic books for 4 years, and so he had training, he said, in visualization, attack, dialogue, and economy. And so it may be that this book is almost a translation of that training, and it's not very smooth because he took all these other things, like the whole I can't say that because it's a spoiler, but the drifting in space thing, that goes back to something in World War II that he wove into there that he saw and was struck by and stuck that away to use in a story sometime.
Yeah, was that on the Wikipedia page about it, or was that in the afterwards? Or
that was in that foreword. It was really an amazing.
Maybe I read that somewhere.
It might have been in the Wikipedia page. I mean, and then the fact that he was talking to a guy in an Italian butcher shop or something, and they started talking about synesthesia, and so that wound up in the book also, which I'm just going to say my daughter has synesthesia, which so I found that very interesting.
Yeah, what I find interesting about synesthesia is that it sounds like she has synesthesia. Oh, the poor girl. Actually, synesthesia is not a disease. It's like just an alternative. It's like
it's basically your brain is connecting a lot of different things that most brains don't connect. Like when she hears words, she experiences textures.
Oh, sound and smooth.
Well, like the word, my name, Julie, I believe means pecan pie. She experiences the texture. I know. Moon is chocolate milk or something like that. I mean, it's all these odd things. And she says some of them, it wasn't until she experienced different foods later on that she went, oh, that's what this word has been connecting to all this time.
This pie tastes like my mom.
Yeah, kind of like that, except it's not the taste. I was checking with her yesterday. It's not the taste. It's the texture. And they're all different ways of experiencing it. Like for a very common one is that you hear words or you hear loud sounds and you see like sculpture in your brain.
You see shapes.
You see
like
colors, shapes,
yeah.
Or you can hear letters and their colors to you. Like I have a friend who I was telling her about this and she said, oh, well, when I hear people's names, they're always a color, green or blue or red, and it's with most people, they don't tell anyone because they find out very young they're weird. So they just don't mention it.
They think everybody is like that. I've read this or heard this quite a bit, is that a lot of people think that they're, that it's just normal. It's like, oh yeah, that number is this color, you know, and they just think that's the way it is.
Yeah, but then they start to get, you know, strange looks from other people.
Right.
They tend to hide it.
Daughter told the mother of her best friend, who said, that's weird. And I was like, oh, so sensitive. So she walked around for the next few days going, I think I'm crazy. Something's wrong with me. Mm-hmm. She was about 8. So she didn't mention it until she was in high school. And I actually was worried she was crazy, but my other daughter had heard something about it on NPR and said, oh my gosh, I know what this is.
Yeah.
She is crazy, so, just like everyone else is crazy.
Yeah, well, they say that babies kind of have that when they're born, and their brain kind of learns to distinguish and channel things. And these people, those connections just stay open. So I just thought it was interesting that he then went, that's what I needed for this piece of the book. I wouldn't have known what it was.
I think this part might age badly. If we give it 100 years, I think synesthesia will seem like a very, it's like throwing a hot air balloon into your story. It sort of loses its prestige if everybody's got a hot air balloon?
Maybe, except they've known about it since they have written records of it from the medieval times, and then people would forget about it, and then they'd rediscover it, and then they'd forget about it again, and then they'd read it. They
yeah,
have all
it's
these
relatively untalked about.
Yeah, well, or they just kind of forget all about it, and then someone would go, "Well, I just heard a woman who, when she hears trumpets, sees bright blue."
Let me throw another grenade later. In here from my introduction. I've got a copy with an introduction by Neil Gaiman.
That's the Masterwork series. Yeah, I had that.
That's the one that I have, too.
Of Time and Gully Fort.
I didn't actually read it, though, because I...
Well, there's a nice short sentence here.
Because you hated the book, but...
No, it's not that I hated the book. I thought it was a very good book. I mean, I thought it was an all right book. I just didn't enjoy it. That's the point, is that I wanted...
Yeah.
Maybe I was expecting more out of it after it's being bigged up, you know, and I understand how it's written. I understand it's a game. I understand it's trying to be very worthy and trying to be enjoy it. And I didn't get
that. Let me give you a sentence here and see what you think of this. The Stars My Destination is, after all, the perfect cyberpunk novel. It contains such carefully proto-cyber elements as multinational corporate intrigue, a dangerous, mysterious, hyper-scientific MacGuffin, Pyre, an amoral hero, and a super cool thief woman. And when I was reading this, I was thinking, yeah.
Jesse, a Cylon.
It sounds to me like it's a cyberpunk-ish novel, but computers really don't play any role in this book at all.
It's like a cyberpunk without any cyber in it.
Before there was cyber.
What I was thinking was that it was more along the lines of a Philip K. Dick novel that had been boiled and boiled and boiled and boiled until a lot of the, you know, it had become hard-boiled in the sense that the character is much more highly motivated to act in the world rather than to have things happen to him. Most Philip K. Dick characters are sort of passive schlubs who have things happen to them and they have to deal with it. Whereas this guy he has something happen to him and then he has to go out and destroy the
universe. Because he's a schlub, that's at the beginning.
Well, he's kind of a schlub. He's more like a useless.
Yeah, and then the other thing I found interesting, though, was at the end, because I agree, Luke, it's not, I don't know if I'd want to reread it, and it's not like I like that character. He's almost like an anti-hero, but you don't want to be like him. But at the very end, when, again, I'm trying to think how to say this, he kind of has some images of the future and some of the people and the things they're saying to him. You realize that for these people to be saying these things, he has gone on and developed further into a more likable character. We just don't get to see that part. We get taken up to that point of extreme change, and then it's done.
There was another section that I want to mention. I know we don't have a lot of time for Julie, but I don't think it's in the Count of Monte Cristo, which is clearly the biggest inspiration, I think, for this story. Mm-hmm. He's actually imprisoned twice. The first is on the ship, which is sort of not the real imprisonment that we later get, which is much clearer when he's thrown into the dungeons of under France, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, pretty obvious. And I think the parallels from there start happening quite obviously with his, you know, he gets his fortune in the same way that the Count from Monte Cristo gets his fortune. Dante is his name? Yeah. He gets his fortune, he finds out about it in the prison and he goes and gets it. That follows nicely. But if you remember, before he's thrown in the prison as a sort of a punishment to find out where the ship is, the Nomad, he is tricked. They try and trick him into revealing the location. And they do it in the same manner that I wrote about recently on the website, the introduction to The Taming of the Shrew. Did you read that article I wrote?
I did read it, now I'm trying to remember, because I thought that was a great subject. But
it was interesting, because it just struck me how Philip K. Dick, the introduction to The Taming of the Shrew, is called The Induction, and it's a scene in which a drunkard, a sort of a man of no importance, is tricked by a lord into believing that his whole life that he remembers is false.
Oh, yeah.
He is a wealthy lord. And the character's name is Christopher Sly. And the play that he's presented with is actually The Taming of the Shrew. So The Taming of the Shrew is a play within a play.
Yeah.
And yet we never see Christopher Sly again, right, at the end of the play. And so it's kind of often it's left off. But that sequence, it's not a framing sequence because it's not followed up on, but that opening is very much similar, and you know, it's even presented in the same way in this story. He's said, you know, you were sick and your delusion was bad, now you're getting better, don't think about those false memories, you just need to talk about it, right? And they present him with a beautiful wife, and they're all actors, right? All these actors are pretending to be his loyal family. And then later on, he takes on that name and presents himself he presents himself as a lord in the same way that happens in The Count of Monte Cristo. Right? He presents himself as the Count of Monte Cristo.
Yeah.
I thought that was just a very interesting sequence, and that's why it felt like, you know, he's got tons of stuff that he's jamming into this book, and when Luke was saying it needed to be edited, I mean, it's 258 pages. It's a short book.
No, right? I'm not saying it needs to be edited for length. I think it needs to be edited to... Well, it's not even that it needs to be edited. It's just like... I just felt it was a very shotgun approach to a theme. You understand? It's like... We're going to do it. We're going to have the theme of this book is going to be transformation. Ah, how are we going to do that? Well, you can do this. And then we're going to have this. And then we can have this. And then we can have this. And we're going to have this. And it's just, it doesn't even feel clever. You know, it's like that whole, like, Julie picked up on the, you know, the Gulliver's Travels thing. I didn't. But now that I found out about it, it's just like, well, that's great. But why did it have to be that society that he went to when he first rescued himself and he got picked up by these people and then he got out? And it's like, so why the tiger in his face? And it's like, there's no reason for any of it.
It feels like one damn thing after another.
Yeah.
But that is a style of writing. You have to remember that there is this style of, you know, storytelling where you send a man on a series of strange adventures, and that's Gulliver's Travels, right? It doesn't have to make sense to you as long as you appreciate that genre.
Yeah, but Gulliver's Travels is I think a very clever satire, and what I liked about this book was the parts when it was a satire, you know, it was more of a satire, you know, and that kind of stuff. But the story itself, what I'm saying is that I really enjoy it when a story is thematic, the plot is thematic. It's so easy to put in any random references into a book. It's like, oh, and this, and then that, and then this. Oh, look, I've read this poem, and I've read this book. And it's like, that's not clever, but to tell a story, you know, when they actually, you know, write something and people go, oh, these two within this book make sense within the book, within the story, but there's nothing in this book which actually makes sense within the book, except with
references. It's a more meta book, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's more of a meta book, and I guess just didn't enjoy it very much. Whereas there's lots of literature
for literature lovers.
Maybe. Yeah, whereas there's lots of other books, even which is sort of like just, you know, like for example, there's the Peter F. Hamilton's current series, where, you know, and there's some, you know, there's a, like a fantasy side of it, and then there's sort of like a very advanced, you know, space opera part of it as well, and everything that is in the book is contained in the book. Sure, there are references to literature, and there's references here and there. But all of it, you know, all of it together tells a story, you know, and I think I mentioned this in the review that I did of the book, is that it's really telling a story about power and the use of power and how power. But it's the theme is really, really well done within the plot of the story and within the characters in the story. And it's really well written. Whereas a book like this, I'm not saying that it's you know, a bad book. It's just that the way that the thematic exploration is without the book. Do you understand what I mean? Not like, it's on the outside of the book. It's not within the story.
I agree.
Yeah, so it's left open. It's left very open for the reader, I think. And the thing is also Bester was preoccupied with Renaissance man as an ideal, which you can kind of see here, although I don't really see Gully as a Renaissance man.
He becomes one.
By the end. But I think he really said he was always a great believer in people and their untapped potential. And so I think this is that shotgun. I think he was looking at it for himself, and it turned into a book that everybody else loved because it did so many other things. But it's kind of like Jesse said, it's like great literature that you don't understand, where you just have to take several shots at it if you care that much. And if you don't like it, then you're not going to care enough. So then that didn't do that job right. But some people will, so they keep coming back to it maybe.
Well, you could probably come back to it too much, but there's one other thing I want to throw out that I'm not sure anyone else will get, because I just got it about 10 minutes before we started recording. I've been reading the classic comics of Monte Cristo, and I was thinking about, you know, it follows a very similar sequence to the certain aspects of the book. You know, we've got 4 Mile of Ceres. That's the name he takes when he gets the platinum and turns to Earth, and right.
Oh,
Well, we've got that same treasure, except in this case, the treasure was on the ship that he was on, right?
Right.
There are disanalogies, but that's not.
Yeah, he goes back to it, doesn't he? He goes back to the ship.
Yeah, he goes back to the ship, and that doesn't happen in the our original story, right? The Count of Monte Cristo. But what I was thinking is, well, there's actually 2 treasures in The Star's My Destination. And one of the treasures is the platinum. But the real treasure is the pyre, right?
Right.
P-Y-R with a capital E. And besides me thinking that this is the inspiration for Pyre Books, P-Y-R Books, you know, the publisher.
Isn't it spelled differently?
Yeah, it's P-Y-R. There's no E.
Ah, okay.
I would bet that they got some inspiration from that. Besides that, I was thinking, well, if this is a symbolic book and it's referencing this other material, what does the pyre represent? And I thought about that for a few minutes, and I kept reading, and then it came to me like that. I knew exactly what the pyre represented.
Tell us.
That is?
Please.
Napoleon. It's Napoleon.
Oh, yeah, because he has to go in. He has to go and save Napoleon, doesn't he? Or not save him, but, you know.
Well, but the whole background of the
reason he's in jail.
The whole reason he's in jail. The whole development of the
story
is that there's this firecracker in the background, this world-changing thing. And if there's anything that was world-changing in the time in which the novel is set, it's Napoleon, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the motivation behind everything. In the end, and it's the MacGuffin hidden behind everything, and that makes me think, well, you know, that's the extra depth that makes me like it all the more, is that I can keep coming back to it and keep looking at it, and it's not just a simple story. I can keep coming back in and keep looking at it and finding new things. If I make those discoveries for myself, I find enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, puzzle at that point, kind of.
Yeah. There's one other thing that I want to mention before we wrap up here, that I wrote down, and something that seems to recur throughout the book is thoughts and versus actions. So like the jaunting is thinking turning into action, and then the pyre itself is you're basically thinking about it exploding. Ooh, is that a spoiler?
Don't worry about it.
All right.
No, it isn't, because
it's
really is.
Yeah.
It really is a MacGuffin. It doesn't actually matter what it was. It just it could have been any.
But I think that he's trying to make a point here, and that might be one of the major themes of the book, is thought turning into action. You know, in the whole character of him, like, you know, when at the beginning, when his ship, when that ship leaves him, his thought changes and his action changes. You know, that's something that captured me anyway. You know, and to me, I felt like it was a major theme that recurred throughout the whole thing.
I'll give one more thing that I think was really terrific. The opening sentences are just terrific. I thought it was very old-fashioned, you know, like a Tale of Two Cities sort of style.
Exactly. That's the other thing, yeah.
This was a golden age, a time of high adventure, rich living and hard dying, but nobody thought so. This was a future of fortune and theft, pillage and rapine, culture and vice, but nobody admitted it. This was an age of extremes, a fascinating century of freaks, but nobody loved it. All the habitable worlds of the solar system were occupied. 3 planets and 8 satellites and 11 million people swarmed in one of the most exciting ages ever known. Yet mine still yearned for other times, as always. And he goes on.
11 million million? I can't remember.
11 million million.
Wow, that's like 11 trillion people.
Well, it's the future, you know.
11 trillion, even though...
We're all living on Jupiter.
That's why they have all those planets.
Yeah, no, I guess when I started listening to it, maybe I just didn't pick up on that. Maybe I thought it was 11 million million. That's a lot. That is a trillion, isn't it? 12 zeros?
It's a big number.
Yeah, but to me, that's why, yeah, that fit in perfectly with the whole thinking of the time, especially that the future is going to be so overcrowded. Soylent Green.
There's another thing that occurred to me too is you know about this jaunting, right? It sort of almost keeps it from being a straight science fiction book. Everything else is very straight science fiction about it. Even telepathy, although I don't think it's very realistic. A lot of people were doing sort of scientific experiments to making, you know, whether it's possible. There's no real evidence that, you know, teleportation has ever been studied as a science, right? So it doesn't quite work. And I was thinking, well, in that case, this future can never happen. But then I revised my opinion a bit when I was thinking about, you know, Second Life. In Second Life, you can go to, zap yourself from one place to another, or you can walk there. And there are no cars, right? Because people can just zap themselves to one place or another.
So you're saying this entire book is cyberpunk and it all happened inside a computer game?
In the future, people will be like, they'll live at home, but they'll go out in, you know, a surrogate style.
Oh, like telepresence, yeah.
And in that case, you know, you can, you know, jaunt from one place to another. But if you want to interact with people on Jupiter, you're going to have to get in a spaceship and fly there because there's still needs for spaceships. And the sort of the setup where there are no local transportations, there's only, walking around a room and then getting in a spaceship. Those are the only two kinds of transportation. It's kind of strange. Could it ever happen? Only in a cyberpunk future, perhaps.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
apologetic. I also liked the fact that a loose end that I noticed from the very beginning when he's encountering Robin, I kept going, this part never got answered. Why did nobody notice this thing he could do that nobody else, you know, she's like, how'd you do that? Well, at the very end, it becomes hugely important. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the point. And I was like, oh, I like that he actually went back and tied that loose end up or held it reserved.
I think that it was a nice tie-up.
To me, that was one of those moments when I went, oh, thank you. I appreciate you thinking about me that much. I've been wondering. So,
that everything else, it was like, I always think it's really funny in these kind of books, and it's like, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and then this happened, and you're like, what? And it's like, ah, yes, because 3 months before, somebody did this. And you're like, oh, right, so that, yes, it's like retroactive foreshadowing, which is one of those weird things.
Yeah, we got chapter 15 is you know, the explanation for chapter 16 and the rest of the book.
Yeah, well, and to me, this was I don't know if anybody else felt this way. I felt it was a very difficult book to read. You had to really pay attention.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that was kind of a barrier I had to overcome.
It skips a lot. You know, it skipped here and well, not skipped, but there was lots of times when it was skipping forward in time quite quickly. So, and if you missed the first sentence or if you didn't pay attention, because I did part of it, like I said, part of it with an audio book and part of it. And if I didn't just miss that first bit, and suddenly I was like, oh, where are they now?
Yeah, he doesn't linger. He jumps.
It's like, that's over. Now let's go 3 months into the future and we'll do this. You know. So
yes, I soon discovered I could not read this before going to sleep at night. There was no way.
So like we were saying, there's no audiobook. There's no official audiobook and there's no chance of it anytime soon.
Which is great for the SF audio.
Yeah, but I do want to highly recommend, I know not everybody loves it so far, but I think it's wonderful, the BBC audio drama dramatization. I think it's one of the finest audio dramas done of a novel ever, because the narrator is actually one of the scientific people, and he tells what happens. He says, you know, he does the opening lines, and then he tells this funny story of this funny man named Gulliver Foyle, and because, you know, they go to him and then they come back. He comes back later. He sort of knows the whole story. And they keep many of the lines from the book. You know, his face was pulpy. It's like, what? He's got a pulpy face? Well, you know, he's in an accident. He's gangrene. Like, it just comes alive a lot more. And that the guy who plays Gully Foyle, in the same way that the narrator in this audiobook that is an unofficial one, the book for the blind, he did a very good job in, you know, giving Gully Foyle the character that's in the book. He's sort of a gruff, stupid,
and also changes throughout. So he starts off that way,
exactly, and he becomes very eloquent.
Here's a good question for the audiobook. Mm-hmm. Valet? Is it valet or valet?
Valet.
Exactly. And he said valet every time, and I was like, that's wrong. And he first said it a few times. And then at one point they go to a chalet, and there's a valet in the chalet. But it's not. There's not a valet in the chalet. There's a valet in the chalet.
Is it valet in the chalet?
Yeah, and I was
Gully Foyle would say it was a valet. Mm-hmm.
No, he won't.
Well, that's one of those things where I would have been listening going, oh, the British, fillet of steak and valet. Okay, got it. And I would have been wrong.
Oh, yeah, fillet and fillet. Yeah, I understand that, I guess. But it really was. No, it didn't bother me. But there's because he gets quite rich and there's lots of valets who, you know, help him here and a valet there and a valet here. But when he actually said there was a valet in the chalet, and I'm like, read the word, look.
Really? Look at the page.
Yeah, I know. And there was a few other times I noticed that I was thinking he has a very, like, English accent, or, you know, it's very English. But then I was thinking, I think this is an American putting on a very good English accent. Yeah. However, it's one of those things, you know, where they get a few bits, you know, patronizing kind of, you know, two words that you'll only know that if you just know that word. But again, valet and valet. Even in America, it's ballet, isn't it? Anyway,
yeah.
Even in America,
I did enjoy the acting and the voice acting in the audiobook. But the language is quite old. You know, you get the Negro girl. Oh, I'm looking for this Negro girl. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
So
it, lucky it wasn't.
Yeah, that was one of the few times that I felt like the book was dated. I thought it.
I
think it's mostly not dated. You know, when I read it, you know, that could
it'll come back into fashion. Come on. I mean, it's everything circular. African-Americans popular now.
Yeah, we'll speak of the
Negro.
We'll have Chicanos and got it. Okay.
Hey, England hit the crossbar. Go ahead.
What? Oh, they've been hitting the crossbar. They hit a crossbar. It went in, and then it bounced, and it didn't even bounce out again, but the goalkeeper reached round, picked the ball out of the goal when it was still bouncing off the crossbar twice, and then took it out.
50 years people are still listening to this podcast.
Listen, I don't even watch, and those refs, I know they're bad.
But it should be 2-2 at the moment, but it's 2-1. I mean, again, I don't. It doesn't matter.
You're anyway, living so let's get back to America's nightmare.
Remember when I said I feel like a bit of a hypocrite saying that it feels a bit like a game that he's playing. It's oh look, this theme and there's all these different things in the book, and we're just going to do this for the theme. And I remember saying that I actually really enjoyed this about Hyperion, where there is lots and lots of references to other books and other stories and other science fiction stories and Shakespeare and all of these different things. However, in that book, I think that sort of served the theme of it, of course, but also served the plot. It served the because it's a collection of what, 6 stories, isn't it, that they tell?
Something like that. And I can't recall.
Yeah, so it's those 6 things. So, but however, like the whole what do you call it, the Canterbury Tales kind of retelling. That, well, it's not mm-hmm. retelling, but it's using that same. Oh, these people are on a pilgrimage, and now they're going to retell the stories. Suits the story that's being told itself, and has a, you know, it seems to have a reason there. And the bit where they sort of start retelling like a bit of Romeo Juliet kind of stuff going on, yeah, that's retold. And these, and a lot of these, you know, and there's one section which is more sort of like noirish hard boiled, and there's these other parts, and but they all seem to serve the story that's being told at the moment. Whereas in this book, I found it didn't do that so much.
Yeah, I've got to tell you, I missed most of these references, you know, that have come up today.
But I still, you know, I just really liked the book. I think I really enjoyed the themes and the whole journey of Gully Foyle. And I did, it's one of the few books that I've read that, you know, I have read it way in the past, but to the, you know, I finished it actually just this morning. And
I saw that on Goodreads.com. Yeah, you were like, page 150.
So,
page 200. I'm like, oh, you got to get there, Scott.
Yeah, but I... If I didn't have this podcast, I would have immediately started the book over, and that is really, really, really rare, because I know that there's some things that I missed in there, and you know, I will be reading it again. Not sure when, but I will.
Yeah,
I want to throw two more things in here, and then I think we can wrap this up. First, there's something we missed again. I just sent you the link. The Pyrenees is where he was. Stuffed in some caves, right? Pyrenees is P-Y-R-E and then N-E-S, right?
Oh, I never thought of that.
Yeah, so that's one thing. The other
it
thing
says classical mythology, there is a Pyrene is the princess who gave her name to the Pyrenees. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's even more of a tie-in.
Yeah, it may be an unknown influence he may have just thought about it, but he said it there anyways. The other thing is, another thing that made the book very cyberpunk was, remember he wires himself? He has himself.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed that part as well.
That was cool. He basically, he's got, you know, it's got the Matrix powers, you know, he can turn himself off time and
yeah, the whole speeding
turn
of time
himself
thing.
On, he clicks his tooth or something and then
Go
punch three guys and then turn himself back on and see what they have to say.
But I really liked it. I mean, a tiny bit of a spoiler. At one point, he doesn't manage to turn himself off. And he's like, So time slows down and then he gets knocked unconscious and time is still too slow. And yeah, it's a good one. There are parts of the book that I like, you know, and to wrap up my review of it, you know, it's one of those sort of like 2.5 stars. There's lots of stuff in the book that I really enjoyed. However, I think the overall project, the overall story, the overall finished product isn't as enjoyable as I thought it was going to be, considering that I remember enjoying it before. But I guess it's maybe, it's just one of those things that I'd maybe expected a bit more or less. I don't know.
Well, maybe we'll have to read it again in 5 years and see if your opinion has changed.
I'm not sure. The thing is, maybe if I actually read a book all the way through, I'd notice different things, because that's the thing when you do it listening to an audio book as well, is that you don't pause it and think about it as much.
That's
so maybe
right.
That's it again. But I just have to, you know, when I on my own podcast, when I do the star ratings, I have to just do it by how much I enjoyed the book. I can't say, you know, I think it's a better book than the enjoyment I got out of it this time.
True, because I gave it 3 stars for that reason. It wasn't a book that I went, oh, everybody must read this book. I liked it and I like talking about it, but I don't know if I'll read it again, or maybe in 5 years.
Yeah,
but it's
give it another 5 years. You can and see.
Then I'll be smart enough to catch more of the references also.
See you again in 2015.
Yes.
I'll give it 3 stars. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars. I think on Goodreads I put 2 stars on it, but that's only because it's only because if I put 3 stars, it would you know,
you like it or something, right?
The thing is, it would be like an overall more enjoyable experience, and I had an overall quite average, not that enjoyable, probably wouldn't have finished it kind of experience.
Did you review this on your podcast?
No, this will be it. Yeah,
this is it. Okay, I didn't know. I was looking around. I didn't see it. I wasn't going to listen because I didn't want to know ahead of time. But okay,
and it's good because we've done this mainly without spoilers. I don't think we've put in any big spoilers here, have we? Except that we've blatantly said, "Oh yeah, it's like the Count of Monte Cristo."
Well, that and mentioned what was a MacGuffin, and I was like, "Whatever."
Yeah, well. We know.
It doesn't ruin the story to know that, actually.
Because you know it's going to be.
I don't think you're going to spoil a book like this. You just have to read it.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. And that's, I think, probably why I didn't like it. Because even, like you say, even if you know the full story, like I did already, I don't know. It's one of those strange things.
It's an experience rather than a...
Yeah, it's more of an experience that you read it. This time I read it, I didn't enjoy the experience very much. Whereas maybe before when I've read it, I did enjoy the experience a bit more.
This has been the SFF Audio Podcast. Please join us at www.sffaudio.com.